Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is an award-winning actor, singer, writer, and producer who's appeared in dozens of musical theater productions, including Ragtime, Mamma Mia, Anything Goes, 42nd Street, Into the Woods, Kiss Me, Kate, Hairspray, and White Christmas. On television and film, he can be seen in Bite Size Halloween, Shut Up Astoria, Wicked Little Town, Chambers, Optima, The Allies, and Cancer Can Rock. But what compelled me to invite him on our show is his remarkable book entitled Cancer, Musical Theater, and Other Chronic Illnesses, which is a brutally honest, turbulent, and sometimes hilarious account of his traumatic but thankfully triumphant experience as a 25-year-old young musical theater star who was suddenly diagnosed with a rare form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The book tells the insightful, compelling, poignant, and ultimately life-affirming story of his 10-month journey back in 2012, navigating the terrifying and tempestuous world of cancer treatment. Originally published in 2017, a special edition was produced in 2022 to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of his victory over cancer. I'm delighted to welcome Edward Miskey to our show. Edward, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Harvey.
Edward, let me start by asking you why you wrote the book.
I wrote the book because I felt as if though the conversation about being a cancer survivor was lacking. You know, a lot happens to you, obviously, and being put out on the other side of it, there's a lot of navigation that you have to do that is very unexpected. It was unexpected to me. And then having conversations with other survivors, there was definitely a through line of, wow, I didn't know that this is how I was going to feel or think or maneuver through life.
Edward, you saw your first Broadway show at the age of 14. It was 42nd Street, starring Christine Ebersole, who just appeared on our show last week, by the way. How's that for a coincidence?
I love that.
And you got to meet her after the show backstage, right?
I did. Yes, my aunt was her dresser.
Well, take us back to that night when you first attended a Broadway show. What was it about musical theater that captivated you so much?
I was from a small town in Pennsylvania, and it was introduced to me at a young age. So, of course, I was already kind of captivated. But the first time seeing 42nd Street was the first time I was in a Broadway theater in a Broadway house. And it just kind of like ripped off all of these different layers of things that were like, it like opened my eyes to like, oh my goodness, people get paid to do this. And like, how exciting and what production value, you know, because like, you know, central Pennsylvania, they do what they can, but it's not a Broadway budget, right?
Your book is filled with amusing references to the great Broadway musicals. Tell us how show tunes helped get you through your cancer ordeal.
So I have always been musically inclined. I grew up with a musical family. My dad's a singer-songwriter. I do that as well. And so like lyrics and the way that music maneuvers and envelops you becomes, whether you intentionally want this to happen or not, becomes a soundtrack for your life. And you pull from those moments of inspiration and songs that speak your language of that moment. And, you know, when you're going through something like that, you almost can't help but revisit that to kind of lift you up or coddle you in a way.
Edward, I can't resist asking you about the time early on in your treatment when you invited your friends for a party as you were getting your hair shaved off. You ate marijuana brownies for the first time. Do you recommend them?
Not in the capacity that I was ingesting them. No, I had way too many of them at once and I didn't know what I was doing. And I kind of eventually, without knowing it, ended up like microdosing the rest of them. But that first time was wild and scary and funny and weird. And, you know, so maybe I recommend them. I don't know.
Maybe one bite just to start.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Before having the stem cell transplant, you were asked if you wanted to freeze your sperm so you could have children one day, and you ultimately decided not to. Was this a difficult decision?
It was a weird decision. I don't know if it was a difficult one. It was, first of all, the conversation was in front of my mom, which was already kind of like, oh God, why am I talking about this in front of my mother? But it was also something that I had never really considered. You know, I was 25, acutely aware that my parents were married at 21 and 22. They had their first child at 26. And like that time was approaching. And so whether it was a hard decision or not, I kind of don't know, but it definitely wasn't a decision that I was equipped or ready to make at that moment.
Do you regret it now?
No.
Then you made the right decision.
I did. Because the other part about that too is that it's only really good for 5 years of storage. So like at this current moment, I would have had like a six-year-old, which is, that's baffling to me.
You wrote about a boyfriend named Valentine, whom you'd been dating for nearly a year and who broke up with you during your cancer treatment. And you wrote about continuing to date during your treatment. How in the world did you find the energy?
It wasn't so much about energy. I don't think I had the energy. It was more about needing the validation to feel normal and doing something that other people were doing that kind of motivated me to do it. I remember being on dates and just feeling like crap, but thinking like, no, I am not a sick person. I will do this.
Everyone knows the cost of healthcare in America is horrendous. Did the Affordable Care Act, commonly called Obamacare, did it help you at all?
Oh yeah. I mean, I wasn't eligible for insurance in America before Obamacare laws passed, and they passed very literally right before I was put into treatment. So I was able to get back on my parents' insurance with that needle being moved to 26 instead of 22 and covered almost everything. I mean, we would have been stuck with a multi-million dollar bill if that wouldn't have been the case.
What's your opinion of the healthcare system in the US?
How long do you got?
All day.
It's not great. It's not great. It is profit-centered, and they're not even trying to hide it anymore. And I think with New York City right now, very currently and topically, having a massive strike of nurses within several hospitals, one of which I was a patient at, you know, I just think that that speaks volumes. It's falling apart. It's not equipped for mass care, and it's not focused on the right things.
I want to give our audience just a sense of what you went through. You had to endure an extremely aggressive course of cancer treatment. You had 4 rounds of unsuccessful chemo, that's 17 chemo treatments over a 3-month period, where they put needles in your spine, followed by radiation for 30 days, followed by a stem cell transplant, which took you literally to the brink of death over a 21-day period in hospital, including 11 days in isolation. Then you had to endure 100 days of trying to get your strength back before you saw your doctor again, who told you that you were cancer-free. And yet, Edward, despite all of that, you wrote that the worst part of your cancer journey for you was after the doctors were finished with you and you had to try to get your life back. Why was that the hardest part of the entire ordeal?
Because when you have a schedule to follow and doctors are telling you, be here at this time, at this day, this is what you can expect, this is what's going to happen, maybe this will be a side effect, maybe you'll feel this way, you're told what your life is going to be like and what is expected of you. And even though it is a catastrophic situation and there's a lot of impossible asks within that context, when you're on the other side of that, all of that structure goes away. And so you have to figure that out on your own, but you have just been sick for almost a year and have to figure out, what do I do when I get up in the morning? There's no one here to tell me I have appointments or go here and do this, and today's chemo day or today's blood draw day or transfusion day, and you have nothing. And so you're very literally starting from the bottom again.
When you got home after the stem cell transplant, you wrote this about what you were feeling, and I'm quoting you here. The unrealistic idea that I was going to be birthed out of the hospital's canal and bounce right back to where I was a year ago, married to the image of me in the mirror, was infuriating. I felt deceived by myself, by the hospital, and by any cultural misunderstanding of what life after cancer was like. Edward, tell us about what your expectations were compared to what the reality was.
I think there's a a false understanding that, like, when you're told you're cancer free, that you just have a big party and everyone's like, yay, and you go back to your job and back to your friends and back to your family and relationships. And that isn't what happened. And even though I kind of on some level knew that that's not how it was going to be, that is still what I expected it to be, because that's what's showcased in movies and TV. And you hear a very surface commentary about cancer survivorship and what that is like, you know, like, oh, you beat cancer, end of story. But the reality of it is that my brain and my body were completely destroyed. I had no career to speak of. I hadn't worked in over a year. I wasn't allowed to work for a certain period of time. And a lot of my friendships and relationships had shifted or changed. And so I was looking at the beginnings of a life that I didn't recognize.
I've always thought that when you go through something really good or really bad, you find out who your real friends are. Did your relationships with family or friends change because of having had cancer?
Oh yeah, in both directions. I had friends leave not speak to me ever again, even to this day. And I've had friends that were thick as thieves, and it's because of that. They were there for me every day. I know who's going to show up for me. I know who they are. I can count on them. Like, they're my people. And same with my family. You know, thankfully no one disappeared or ghosted or couldn't handle it, but my parents and I and my sisters and I, we have a very, very strong relationship, partly because of that period of time.
Well, I want to tell you something, Edward. When I was reading your book, I fell in love with you, and I wished that I could have been there for you during that time, because I wanted to be your friend. That's how well you write.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You wrote about something called the fear spiral after recovering from cancer. It's a form of PTSD, correct?
Correct, yes.
It's panic and anxiety and hypochondria and a fear that cancer will return.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's wild.
How did you deal with it?
I started out in a therapy space, kind of. I think some of it was just being around people and allowing myself to ease into that normalcy feeling of like, oh, I have my life back. Everything's going to be okay. Unfortunately, my poor mother ended up being my therapist for a lot of this. And I would call her and, you know, be like losing it about something like a bruise not healing fast enough or, you know, something like that. But it really just came to learning how to talk to myself and talk myself down, because I, you know, of course, didn't want to be a burden to my mom. And that's a whole other layer of things as well once you're through something like that. But, you know, being able to talk to myself and be like, it's not real. It's gone. There is no evidentiary proof that this is going to happen again. You're good. Calm down.
Well, at one point, Edward, you decided to go to a therapist who you nicknamed Siri, because all she did was paraphrase and repeat everything you said to her. So you discontinued therapy. What should therapy for a cancer patient look like?
Oh, good question. I think it needs to be a combination of traditional therapy as we know it and problem solving. I found that a lot of times when I would go into this person's office and sit there and talk to them about how I was feeling and what was going on, that I would just get a, how does that make you feel response? And they're like, I'm more solution oriented and more action taking oriented. And so like, that's a good first step for me, but I would have liked someone to be like, okay, well, let's take this information and move it to the next step. And how can we fix that?
Yeah. You're a problem solver.
I would like to think so.
A lot of cancer survivors have told me that cancer actually made them a better person. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that.
Do you have a better attitude, a hunger for life? You pick your battles more carefully. You kind of understand what matters in life and what doesn't?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I say a lot that the person I was before any of this happened was completely disagreeable, and I would not want to hang out with that person. You know, they were know-it-all. They thought that they had everything together and they knew what they were doing 100% of the time. And like, you know, as cancer or anything catastrophic like that would, it knocked me down a few pegs. So, you know, I definitely think it gave me a little bit more empathy and a little bit more insight to my self-awareness, and I hope a better person.
You mentioned insight into yourself. What would you say cancer taught you about yourself?
Ooh, that I am much more capable at a lot of things than I give myself credit for.
That's nice to hear, because you always had those capabilities. You just may not have recognized them.
Yeah. And that continues to be true. And that's part of self-discovery in life, isn't it?
Well, one thing you discovered about yourself, you can write really well.
Thank you.
What advice do you have for anyone out there watching this interview who might be fighting cancer right now?
Surround yourself with people you trust. Find something to give yourself either a distraction or a coping mechanism, as long as it's not harmful. I started a magazine, an online magazine while I was in the hospital, and that kept me going. You know, that gave me the sense that other people were relying on me, and that, you know, moved me right along. I think there's a lot of talk about legacy as a human when you're going through something like that, where there's a big question mark at the end of the road and you don't know what that's going to look like for you in the end. I think really, really evaluating a legacy piece for yourself, whether that's something that is important to you or not, would be something to sit with.
Now, Edward, I want to ask you a bit about your career following cancer. Within 6 months following the stem cell transplant, you booked 3 shows back to back, and you've gone on to do lots of shows. You wrote this about acting. You said that for every performance an actor does, there is someone, even if it's just one person in the audience, who desperately needs what you're doing on that stage, whether they realize it or not. So, Edward, is that why you love acting so much?
I think that is what I came to the conclusion of why I liked acting so much. Before I had cancer, I think it came down to I liked being on stage and having spotlights and makeup and costumes. And it was something I was good at, and I received positive reinforcement for by booking things in the first place, making money doing it. And then, of course, you know, audience applause. You know, and that was the disagreeable person that I used to be. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But after going through something like that, it really kind of was the impact that it had on me during that period of time. And then subsequently, years later, having others approach me or message me through social media to tell me the same about my work, that really kind of reinforced that component of acting in theater to me.
So do you like who you are now?
I do. And it's something that I work on daily to like more and more. But again, comparatively, I like me a lot better now than I did back then.
Well, you come across extremely likable in the book, even more likable in the interview. So what's next for Edward Miskey?
I am actually taking this book and adapting it to screen. I am writing a musical episodic TV show. We're working on the pilot right now with my producing partner, Sarah Seeds. And I'm hoping to be at least in pre-production for that by the end of summer this year.
So when that comes out, can I get you to promise me that you'll come back on our show to promote it?
Oh, I guarantee I'll do it. Yes.
I want to tell our viewers that you can learn more about Edward Miskey by going to his official website, edwardmiskey.com. Well, Edward, I really enjoyed your book. It's been a pleasure having this conversation with you. And I wish you the very, very best of luck with the film adaptation of the book.
I'm so excited about it. Thank you, Harvey.
I truly believe you were saved and cured for a reason. And I'm so glad that you're continuing to shine your light on the world in such a beautiful way. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Our guest has been actor, singer, writer, and producer Edward Miskey, whose book, Cancer, Musical Theater, and Other Chronic Illnesses, is available wherever books are sold. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to our producer, Steve Silver, my wonderful managers, Rick and Robin at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, and my entire team at XPTV1 in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.